It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later this hour, a new AP report tracks the impact of ethanol production on the environment and says there's a lot of damage being done by federal ethanol requirements.
First, it's geek out time again with Wisconsin's own Patrick Rothfuss. This time around, Pat's on to share some great novels to help people get into fantasy and science fiction. He's the best-selling fantasy author of The Name of the Wind and The Wise Man's Fear. Pat, welcome back to the show.
Hey there.
So obviously you're a big fan of fantasy and science fiction. Why do you want to help evangelize for those genres for our listeners?
Well, I know what I hear from my readers a lot sometimes. They come up to me and they say, oh, you know, I've never read a fantasy book before I read yours. Or they say, I used to read fantasy when I was younger and then I fell away from it and now I'm back. And I've heard it so often that, you know, it's made me realize that a lot of people find it hard to kind of break in, but it's just like any genre. You know, once you are familiar with it and once you love it, it's easy to find books. But, you know, coming in is hard if you don't know what you're looking for.
Do you think there's a stigma attached to these genres at all? You know, kind of like how when Harry Potter was cresting, people on the subways would want to read ones with adult covers or ones that looked a little more camouflaged.
I think there is a little bit. It's probably not as bad as it used to be, but there is still a little bit of the misapprehension that fantasy is just for kids, you know, or it's kind of silly stuff that's just elves and dragons and magic, when that really couldn't be further from the truth, and anybody who reads in the genre, you know, knows that.
All right, so picture a listener out there. They head over to the library or the bookstore, and they head over to the fantasy and science fiction section, and they're overwhelmed by the hundreds and thousands of choices they have. What's a good place for them to start?
Well, I would probably, if I got to do it person to person, I would ask them, you know, what are you looking for? Do you like an action story? Do you like, you know, do you have a real love of the language? Do you like beautiful language? Because we all look for different things in stories. Are you looking for emotive characters? Do you like a little romance? Because, you know, there isn't just one type of fantasy. There isn't just one type of science fiction. But, you know, there's some go-tos. There's some books that I will hand to almost anyone with the knowledge that so long as they're not horribly prejudiced against the genre, odds are they'll enjoy them.
What is one?
Neverwhere is from Neil Gaiman, and it's a book that I have 10 copies of. I'll give it to anyone. And if you can't enjoy Neverwhere, then maybe fantasy isn't for you. One of his other books that I very much enjoy is Stardust. Neverwhere is my favorite. Stardust is my girlfriend's favorite. And they have amazing followings. If you want to maybe go in the science fiction direction, I would recommend Old Man's War by John Scalzi. Or if you want to get a little harder, a little heavier, you can go back a bit and read some Philip K. Dick, the book Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? That's the book that Blade Runner, the movie, was based off of. And it's in no way similar to the movie, but it's an amazingly good read.
Well, let's just assume someone is completely ignorant of this. Tell us a little bit about the plots of some of these. Let's start with Neverwhere.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch
that. Can you tell us about the plots, some of what we might expect to read? Let's start with the Neil Gaiman suggestions you just gave.
Well, Neverwhere, it was probably one of the early precursors of urban fantasy, by which I mean fantasy novels that are set in the real world. And in that book, you know, the main character, Richard Mayhew, becomes acquainted with the London that he lives in. It's not the only London there is. He lives in London above, but there's also a London below, a different London that a different sort of person lives in. The people that slip through the cracks of the real world. And it's fascinating because it's about London, but it also has this strong mythic undercurrent, and it's a great example of that urban fantasy genre.
Well, let's take some of the subsets you said. Suppose somebody answered your initial question saying, Pat, yeah, I'll give it a try, but I need some fancy writing. I want some beautiful writing in anything I read. Where's some place to go for that?
If you wanted some beautiful language, like the best language I've ever possibly read in a book is from The Last Unicorn by Peter S. Beagle. It's a cornerstone in the fantasy genre. And if you hesitate picking up a book with like a unicorn in the title, that's understandable. But you have to realize that this book is why unicorns are cliche now. This is the book that made everyone fall in love with the concept of the unicorn. It is my absolute favorite novel.
And really?
Yeah, absolutely. I read it once a year. And every year I think, maybe I was wrong. Maybe it's not as good as I remember it. And every year it is better than I remember it. I've had arguments with people who, you know, and a lot of us saw the cartoon.
Yeah, that's what I remember of The Last Unicorn.
Yeah, and, you know, honestly, it freaked a lot of kids out because it was this old Rankin and Bass animation and parts of it were a little spooky. But the book is perfect and sweet and beautiful, and there's not a word out of place. It's, you know, if I could buy everyone in the world a copy of The Last Unicorn, I would.
Well, I don't think you can get much higher praise than that for a book.
He'll defend that one on the field of honor, definitely.
Can you read that one to kids? Is it a kid's book, Patrick, or is it more of a grown-up thing?
There's not issues of like adult content in it. I think some of the language might be rough, maybe, you know, if you're younger than 14, you know, 16. Mm-hmm. You know, but then again, an adult is going to get more out of the book than a kid, or rather different things. Because I remember growing up, I loved Schmendrick the Magician, you know. And then, like, more recently when I reread it, one of the older characters, I'm like, wow, how did Peter S. Beagle write this when he was 20 years old? You know, because I can really empathize with this older character who feels this just so weary with the world.
Now, one book that Rob and I have passed back and forth, Rob read it, I haven't. And I think that I heard that you like this one as well, is Ready Player One by Ernest Cline. Is that one that you recommend?
Absolutely. It was actually here on my list, especially if you were a child of the 80s. It's nice, light, well-written sci-fi, and it's like a love poem to the 80s. It's got all this, it's an 80s montage. So if you were any sort of even a very mild geek, you will be reminded of all these things in the book, you know, from your childhood. It felt like he wrote that book just for me.
I was going to say, I felt like I was maybe a little too micro-targeted. Yep, had that, read that, played that, just like every main plot point keyed around a part of my 80s teen years.
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of people felt that way. And that by itself just shows the degree of craft in there. If you can convince 250,000 people that a book was written just for them, you know, that by itself shows that, you know, the amount of craft that's being put into these fantasy novels.
So the 80s references are in there, but this is about a video game, isn't it?
It's a cool, like, kind of post-apocalyptic U.S. where in this world, a person who grew up in the 80s effectively created immersive online virtual reality and then said he would leave his vast software empire to whoever beat, you know, whoever solved this riddle, whoever beat this game. And then so an entire, you know, generation of kids grew up learning about the 80s so they could unravel the puzzles. The 80s-based puzzles that he put in the game. So it's set, I think, 60 years in the future, but all the references are 1980s references. It's a really interesting melange.
All right, one more of your opening questions I wanted to get to. The category of people who want a ripping good yarn, they want a well-constructed plot and some nice action scenes. Can you give us a book or two for that audience?
I'll give you two, both of them fantasy. One of them is the Mistborn trilogy by Brandon Sanderson. It's good action. It's cool secondary world with interesting magic in it. And good action, good plot. The other one is a book that I've recently reread and realized that I did not give it enough credit my first time through. It's called Lies of Locke Lamora. And that actually is a real rarity, where it's a combination of this beautiful secondary world fantasy. It's another world, but it's a heist novel. And on top of that, the language is beautiful too. It's really got everything that I want in a book. And that one is by Scott Lynch.
All right. Looks like we've got some good reading to take us into these colder months. Patrick, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Patrick Rothfuss, best-selling fantasy writer of Name of the Wind and The Wise Man's Fear.
Coming up, we'll find out how ethanol production is affecting the environment, according to a new report from the AP. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. In 2005, under President George W. Bush, mandates required oil companies to add ethanol to their gasoline. Ethanol was seen as a cleaner fuel that could help cut reliance on foreign oil.
As the eighth largest ethanol-producing state, this transition has had an impact on agriculture and land use here in Wisconsin.
A report out today, it's gotten a lot of attention. It's by the Associated Press, and it questions whether ethanol has achieved its goals, says the industry has harmed the environment and decreased conservation land in the process. With us now is one of the reporters who broke the story, Dina Capiello. She's the National Environmental Reporter for Associated Press in Washington, and the report is called The Secret Dirty Cost of Obama's Green Power Push. Dina, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So we mentioned that some of these mandates started before President Obama, but he gave it a boost. Talk about how President Obama committed to ethanol as an alternative fuel.
Well, obviously, you know, let's go back to when he was a senator from Illinois. He was very supportive of policies that would incorporate ethanol and gasoline. Then he started to run for president, was a big supporter of ethanol in Iowa during, obviously, the very pivotal caucuses. We talked to one of his campaign advisors at the time who said it was one way that he distinguished himself from the field. And so obviously he played a big role in his election. He's been a longtime supporter before getting into the White House. And now as president, while of course he didn't sign this bill into law, that was President George W. Bush, it's his administration that has actually been the one to implement it. And actually the EPA and the RFS is one of the first, you know, major environmental undertakings that his administration did when he got into office.
And what's the argument? What's been the logic behind adding ethanol to the gasoline we use in all our cars?
Well, the original argument was twofold. One was to wean ourselves off foreign oil. Let's remember, I mean, back in 2007, oil prices were really high. And the second major argument for ethanol was that it would be better than petroleum-based gasoline from a greenhouse gas emissions perspective. And so those were the two primary arguments when this law was passed. But a lot of things have changed since those initial arguments were made.
So what are some of the things that have changed since they first made that case?
Well, first of all, for one, we're importing, you know, far less foreign oil than we were in 2007, in large part because our country is producing a lot more homegrown oil and gas because of techniques to get at tight oil. For instance, in the Bakken shale of North Dakota, we fuel efficiency standards have improved our gasoline mileage, so we're actually using less gasoline as a country, and so all of these things weren't factored in, and then. Obviously, even on greenhouse gas emissions, because of the recession, we are doing better on those from an energy standpoint.
So the marquee finding in your study has been the impact of ethanol requirements on how much corn farmers are growing and, in turn, on our land. Can you talk about that a little, please?
No, absolutely. So obviously, you know, corn ethanol created a huge new market for corn here in the U.S. and helps drive up corn prices. And, you know, any smart farmer who sees prices go up on a commodity says maybe I should start planting it. And that's indeed what happened. I mean, since the ethanol mandate was passed, we have 15 million more acres of corn in this country. And that had to go somewhere. And some of that was crop switching, but some of that was also conversion, two kinds of conversion. One, from land that was long fallowed in a conservation reserve program where farmers were paid to actually fallow environmentally sensitive land. And then in addition, we also found evidence through the USDA and through our own analysis of actually people breaking in to, you know, what we would call native or virgin grasslands that haven't been in crop or row crop before. So, and that has a lot of environmental consequences. First and foremost, obviously, anybody that's seen, you know, a farmer turn over a field, obviously you're exposing the soil, there's soil runoff. A lot of these places where corn is being grown are on marginal soils that are not great for the crop. That drives fertilizer use. That runs into waterways, causing algal blooms and problems for water supplies, like the Des Moines Water Works that you mentioned in our story. And then it also has, all of that change has a greenhouse gas impact. When you apply nitrogen to fields, that releases nitrous oxide. It's a very powerful greenhouse gas. And actually taking out the grass and replacing it with corn also releases greenhouse gases. So there is a greenhouse gas consequence to that as well.
So not surprisingly, there's been some angry response to your report today and even before it came out. And one of those, there have been a bunch of arguments. One says, no, land isn't going from the Conservation Reserve Program to corn because of ethanol. It's because funding was cut to the Conservation Reserve Program when Congress couldn't pass a farm bill. Is that part of the factor, or are you seeing it's more the corn ethanol?
Well, listen, and this is a kind of a chicken and egg argument, and obviously we've seen the criticism about our piece. You know, I talked to the lawmakers on the Hill that worked on the 2008 Farm Bill and are working on the current Farm Bill, and, you know, what they would say is that the lowering of the CRP cap was a response to market forces, that farmers didn't really want to enroll in the program, that, you know, that prices had gone up in part because of the ethanol mandate, in part because of international demand, and they wanted to plant corn. And actually, if you look at testimony that was given in June to Congress by the USDA chief economist, I mean, he actually makes this point that ethanol indeed helps drive up corn prices, and in turn, that led to some land conversion.
I wanted to ask you about Wisconsin. Obviously, this is part of why we're talking about it here. Wisconsin is a big corn state, not the biggest, but and ethanol has been an issue here, too. What kind of things did you find out about Wisconsin?
Well, we looked, obviously, what we basically did was we looked at both corn acreage before the mandate went into effect, which was in 2006, and compared it to 2012, which is the latest full data set we had available. And when you do that for the state of Wisconsin, in that time frame, so from 06 to 2012, there was 700,000 additional acres put into corn. In addition, for each state, we also looked at what happened to the conservation land. And there are actually 9 counties in Wisconsin that lost more than half of their conservation land in that same time frame. Now, obviously, one of the big challenges in reporting a piece like this is it's very difficult because you can't really get down to the farm level because of privacy concerns to figure out exactly what acre of CRP was lost and what it went into. So what we had to do is we had to just look at those two variables. Where did corn go up and where was CRP lost, not only on a statewide basis but on a county basis, which is what was the smallest kind of area we could look at.
And what did you find county by county? Did you find in particular counties conservation land goes down, corn goes up?
We did in some counties. Again, as I said, there were 9. We published a list of counties in the Corn Belt that saw some of the biggest changes, and 9 of Wisconsin's counties were on that list. And all of them had lost half or more of their conservation land since the corn ethanol mandate came to be.
And the logical conclusion you're thinking is corn prices go up in part because of the ethanol requirement, way outpaces the conservation money from the federal government. It's a logical choice for farmers.
Absolutely. And farmers told us that. They told us that in Iowa. They told us that in South Dakota. that they made that decision. Now, obviously, as you all know, being from an agricultural state and an ethanol state, there are good actors and there are bad actors, and a lot of farmers are planting more corn. Not only for ethanol, but for other reasons, and doing conservation practices that mitigate the impact, right? Whether that's waterways, whether that's buffers to reduce soil runoff, but some aren't. And we saw the consequences of that on the ground in Iowa.
We're talking to Dina Capiello. She's national environmental reporter for the Associated Press in Washington, D.C. We're talking about the AP's new report on the impact of ethanol mandates.
And we'd like to hear your thoughts on this. Do you grow corn or are you involved in the ethanol industry? Have you seen the effects of the ethanol industry in your own town? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're back with Dina Capiello, the National Environmental Reporter for the Associated Press in Washington, D.C. We're talking about the impact of ethanol production on the environment.
And you can join the discussion at 800-642-1234. Do you grow corn? Are you involved in the ethanol industry? Do you have an opinion on whether ethanol should be required in our gasoline? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to the phones. We've got Jim with us now in Iowa County. Jim, hi, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. Hello?
Yep. What did you want to bring up, Jim?
Oh, sure. I'm the county conservationist in Iowa County. And over the last 4.5 years, we've had 23 square miles come out of CRP, which had to be highly erodible land, shallow soils and slopy land, mm-hmm. and 23 square miles probably all went into corn and beans.
So that...
And I'm glad to hear you're having a conversation about the environmental effects of growing corn and beans. And historically, we used to, the USDA used to factor in soil loss as a cost of production, and they don't do that anymore. So we're having a real challenge out here to working with farmers on raising corn and beans on sensitive soils and encouraging no-till waterways and buffers, as your guest had mentioned. So I'm real glad you're having this conversation, and I was glad to see the article in today's paper.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Jim. So that's he mentioned the CRP, the Conservation Reserve Program. He's seeing what you're talking about there.
That's exactly right. I mean, that is – I mean – If it wasn't a county in Wisconsin, he could have been calling from southern Iowa where we were. I mean, a very, very similar story. It's a very, slightly kind of hilly landscape, very highly erodible soils, not great for corn, and it's going into corn. And we talked to conservationists that are struggling like he is to kind of get every farmer on board. And we actually went to a Rathbun Lake, which is one of the, I think it's the largest rural water supply in the country, and they literally, the managers of the water supply, are actually mapping the land use conversion and actually have rated where people are converting and saying, this is really high priority because this is going into our waterways, and they're going out, and they're one by one talking to those farmers and trying to convince them to do these conservation practices, which we all know work to mitigate some of these impacts.
And you're seeing, you wrote about nitrate pollution in a lot of waterways that towns rely on.
Absolutely. I mean, we talked to the Des Moines Water Works, which, for the first time this year, both of the rivers that supply its water had high nitrates. Usually in years past, one is high and it can go to the other one. But this year, both of them had high nitrate levels, and they actually had to turn on these huge machines, very expensive, very energy intensive, to filter out the nitrates. And they also showed us data looking at the trend line in terms of the nitrate concentrations in their water sources. And the trend line is up since the ethanol boom, in large part because of the land conversion that has happened. And we're not saying I want to make something very clear to people. Obviously, this mandate has caused people to take, fields that were in wheat and plant them to corn. There's been crop switching. And we're talking about both direct and indirect land use changes. I mean, direct meaning that people are, planting corn that goes into an ethanol plant and becomes ethanol and goes into a gasoline plant. But because of the share of the corn market, more corn has to be planted for other purposes. And that's where you get kind of the indirect land use change that we've talked about.
Thanks for the call, Jim. We'll go to Jackie now in Sun Prairie. Jackie, hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. I am a farmer's daughter whose father put, maybe 40 good acres into conservation, we used to call it. And the land was marginal and somewhat marshy. But the question I have, though, is that I read the paper today, the article in the paper, and it seemed to not only imply, it stated that it was the result of the Obama administration. And I wondered if that was the intent of the people who wrote it, or how much influence does the Obama administration have on this whole business of repurposing that land again back to corn?
Well, the reason why we focus on, it's a very good question, by the way. Obviously, you know, the President George W. Bush signed this into law, but the implementation of that law, the rules that are written to make that law work, were done all under Obama. And I think as we talk about in the article, some of the things that they put in place to police the environmental consequences, especially the land use and what we call new breaking, which is your farmer's daughter, you know what I mean, when you're breaking ground that hasn't been planted before, actually mask the problem. So I think that we talk about the Obama administration, not only because it's him in the White House and he's been a big supporter of the RFS and the ethanol mandate, but because it was some of the decisions that his administration made in terms of how we're going to keep track of the environmental consequences that aren't doing a great job seeing the issue. In addition to the land use change, we point out in the article that the law required the EPA, and this would be under Obama, the EPA to do air quality and water quality studies, you know, independent, them doing it, not relying on prior research, and that has not actually happened.
Speaking of the Obama administration, his agriculture secretary, Tom Vilsack, responded to the report saying, while conservation land has declined in that conservation reserve program, all of conservation has not declined. They say there are other kinds of land, wetlands in part, going back into conservation. Is that true? Do you buy that?
It is true, but you have to remember there are different types of conservation land. So we looked at CRP. Why did we look at CRP? Because CRP is fallowed cropland that's in there for a decade, sometimes more if they renew the contract. It's really allowed to return to its natural state. It's not. It's minimally managed, if managed at all. What the secretary was talking about, and he made the same point when he spoke to ethanol lobbyists here on the Hill, is other conservation programs that are put in place on actually active farmland. And that's a whole different, you know, ball of wax, for lack of a better term. We looked at CRP lands because they are fallowed and they are natural, and there is a consequence to converting them. What he was talking about when he talks about CSP and EQIP are conservation programs that actually happen on active farmland that is being cropped.
Gotcha. We'll go back to the phones now. We've got Roger with us in Wanakee. Roger, hi.
Thanks for taking the call. What a beautiful subject to be broaching. I just got back from South Dakota a couple of weeks ago, and in the pheasant population, wildlife, deer, pheasants are down in some areas 80% in the last couple of years. They've had bad winters, but a lot of it is just because this grassland is just being removed from the system and put into corn. Driving down the road, you're looking at this native prairie. It's never been plowed, ever. And the land is going into corn at a rate that's unprecedented in the last 100 years. It just breaks your heart to see that.
And all right, Roger, thanks. I want to get a response from Dina. So converting this this prairie land into cropland and its impact on wildlife.
Absolutely. Hey, Roger. Hey, I love the segue. That's a great segue for me. We actually have another piece that is going to be hitting the wire at 12:01 a.m. on Wednesday morning. actually anchored in South Dakota, talking about grassland conversion. We actually did a satellite analysis looking using both agricultural satellite data, USDA agricultural satellite data, and also the U.S. Geological Survey data to kind of get to that grassland conversion you're talking about. And we're not talking about CRP, right, which is once cropland. We are talking about native grasslands that as far as we know, have never been cropped. And we looked at actually just kind of the Corn Belt. And what we found in our analysis, and we actually subtracted CRP to be very conservative and not double count it, is that 1.2 million acres of grasslands has gone into either corn or soybeans since the ethanol mandate came to be. And so that's the number that we got. We also had another number in our story. For the first time in 2012, the USDA tried to get a handle on what we call new breakings or sod busting. There's a couple ways to refer to it. And in 2012 alone, they saw 38,000 acres of new breakings. And so, again, we saw exactly what you're talking about, not only in Iowa and South Dakota, in southern Illinois, in Nebraska, in Minnesota. It's not really hard to find it if you know where to look.
Before we let you go, Dina, a new farm bill is moving at its glacial pace through Congress now. Is the idea of keeping this ethanol mandates in place, the ethanol subsidies in place, being reconsidered now?
The farm bill, I mean, I think what's being reconsidered is the renewable fuel standard, which is obviously separate of the farm bill. There is obviously a movement afoot to repeal the corn ethanol portion of the RFS. Senator Dianne Feinstein of California and Senator Coburn are working on legislation to do that. And then any day now, and I think it may be as soon as tomorrow, the EPA is going to release the volumes under the RFS for 2014. As you may have recall, and for the 2013 numbers, they already really reduced cellulosic, kind of recognizing that cellulosic wasn't quite there. But we're expecting them in the 2014 numbers actually to reduce the volumes for corn ethanol. So that's, I think, really interesting to watch. On the subsidy portion, I think there's been a recognition that this is the ethanol industry, you know, is booming. It's doing well, and I haven't heard any pushes in Washington to reinstate the subsidies.
All right. Dina, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks so much, guys. I really appreciate it.
That's Dina Capiello, National Environmental Reporter for the Associated Press in Washington, D.C.
First, a look at a potential crisis point in the Middle East from the Arab Spring through civil war in Syria. One group of nations in the Middle East has resisted the turmoil in the region, the Persian Gulf monarchies like Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, and others. But our next guest says their apparent stability is misleading.
Christopher Davidson joins us now. He's a reader in Middle East politics at Durham University, the author of After the Sheiks, The Coming Collapse of the Gulf Monarchies. Christopher, welcome to the show.
Good evening. Many thanks.
So before we get into the heart of your argument, let's talk about what's at stake. How big a deal is it for the world if Saudi Arabia and these other countries are thrown into some kind of upheaval?
Well, historically, they've played a key role in the oil-rich Gulf region, providing both stability to the international economy and, of course, since 9/11, also really performing something of a backbone role for the United States and the Western powers in the war on terror. We shouldn't forget that the majority of the 9/11 hijackers were actually from Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf monarchies. Plus, a lot of the money was laundered and wired through these states, too.
Well, and let's follow up on that some. A lot of the rulers of these countries have aligned themselves with the United States in some respects diplomatically and accepting military bases. How popular is that with the populace at large in the countries we're talking about?
Yes, this is extremely controversial. Although the West hasn't actually deployed bases in Saudi Arabia, there are nonetheless U.S. drone bases there very discreetly. And various Western forces have clearly had to move through Saudi Arabia over the years. But in Kuwait, Qatar, and Bahrain being the home to the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet, this is extremely delicate given the sentiments of the local populations. Having large contingents of non-Arab, non-Muslim, foreign soldiers and Navy personnel situated there.
Now, that reminds me of the situation in Iran previous to the revolution. You had a very pro-U.S. Shah there and a population not crazy about that coziness with the United States? I know it's a very different situation here in some other ways, but do you see an analogy there?
I think that's a good point, and I think there are certainly many parallels between the current Gulf monarchies and the Shah of the 1960s and 1970s, where essentially we had a ruling elite operating out of touch of the reality of the Iranian street, as it were. It's the same in many of the Gulf states, where we have strong religious beliefs, believing that Islam should play a key role in government, and also Islam should actually be the foundation for democracy. But many of the Gulf states have been arresting moderate political Islamists on the grounds they are criminals and terrorists. They're unwilling to face an Arab Spring of their own, of course. We've even had the Muslim Brotherhood organizations in the Gulf monarchies being criminalized too. This has made it very difficult, of course, for Gulf monarchs to still portray themselves as pious rulers with Islamic credentials.
And the movement seems to be toward more, not less, autocracy. And is that one of the things that has you worried about the stability of these regimes?
Yes, certainly. The book really describes a convergence of many different factors, including the rapidly changing economic conditions in these states, their international relations, too, and also the massive crackdown and clampdown that's happened over the past 2 years. Essentially, the Gulf monarchies have responded to the Arab Spring in their own backyards with two strategies, the stick and the carrot, arresting large numbers of political prisoners. Even in the United Arab Emirates, considered one of the most open of these countries, we have one of the highest political prisoner rates per capita in the world now. And alongside that, they've been ramping up public spending massively to try and keep money in people's pockets.
And then we mentioned Iran circa 1970s earlier, but also Iran, you write, today, the Shiite theocracy of Iran and the threat it presents to Saudi Arabia and other countries' role in the region. That's an issue you see as another source of instability there. Can you talk about that?
Yes, absolutely. The Iran of today is, of course, very different to the revolutionary Iran of the 1980s and even 1990s. Iran today, with a democratically elected president, Rouhani, represents in many ways an existential threat for the autocratic Gulf monarchies. These are Gulf monarchies which have historically portrayed themselves as America's best friend in the region, where America has really been obliged to turn a blind eye to their autocratic governments, perpetual human rights abuses, etc., in exchange for guaranteeing the smooth access of oil exports. Now the conditions have changed greatly. We have a far more moderate presidency in Iran, of course. We also have the rapidly changing oil dynamics of the United States now having overtaken Saudi Arabia, Russia, etc., to be the world's number one oil producer. So the very pillars of this relationship are changing very quickly.
I wonder if people in Saudi Arabia and the other Kuwait and elsewhere are looking at Iran and seeing, all right, you've got this Shiite country that has really made itself the defender of the faith for the Shia world. Why isn't my country being the same thing for Sunni Islam? Is that a sense of the street, I guess, in these countries?
Yes, I think that's a very key point. Also, we shouldn't forget, in many of the Gulf monarchies, there is actually a substantial Shia population as well. They just never had any significant representation in these autocratic governments. In Bahrain, for example, where we have a Sunni ruling family, we actually have a Shia majority of the population, which are still pressing ahead with their 2.5-year-old revolution that's often described as the inconvenient revolution, given that Bahrain is ostensibly an ally with the United States. But even in Saudi Arabia, we have a huge Shia minority, ironically, in the eastern part of Saudi, where the bulk of the oil fields are.
And in the repression of Shia activism, do the leaders there say, well, you're just, you're pro-Iranian spies, in effect, as opposed to political dissidents in our own country?
Yes, for many years, but especially since the beginning of the 2011 Arab Spring Revolution, this was the knee-jerk reaction of the Sunni Gulf monarchies to blame any kind of insurgency on Iranian Shia-backed fifth columnists, foreign agents, etc. That's really starting to wear off now. We've had independent investigations and commissions in Bahrain, for example, which have described that there isn't a shred of evidence connecting Iran to these Shia revolts. Moreover, some of the Gulf monarchies don't have a substantial Shia population. That's why in the United Arab Emirates, they've had to deal with their pro-democracy opposition by branding them as extremist political Islamists.
And I'm going to make a massive understatement here. The relationship between Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, other countries, and Israel has been difficult. How does that fit into this this picture of instability in the near future?
It fits in very closely. If you look at the situation at the moment, the two powers who most want the United States to fail in its peacemaking with Iran are Saudi Arabia and Israel. So in many ways, these are two powers in the region that are working together, but officially separately. However, there's a whole raft of security, intelligence, and increasingly business links connecting Israel to the six Gulf monarchies. As you appreciate, this has to be done very carefully by these monarchies, as the bulk of their population are distinctly anti-Israel, not anti-Jewish or anti-Semitic, I should add, but anti-Israeli, given the clampdowns on the various resistance and intifada in Palestine.
Just a couple years back, we saw, as I mentioned earlier, the Arab Spring. I don't know that a lot of people predicted it. It started in, I think it was Tunisia, and quickly swept through a bunch of other countries. Do you see something like that happening, a domino effect where maybe one of the smaller countries goes into mass revolt, maybe a coup or something like that, and then we see a similar spring of sorts, whatever season it is that it happens, in the other Gulf monarchies?
Yes, I think what we're waiting for in the Gulf monarchies is some kind of trigger incident to happen. We don't know exactly what that will be. It may be a particular outrage, a political prisoner is killed, a particular riot takes place, or perhaps more likely that Saudi Arabia goes through three or four kings in the space of the next few years, given that they're all well into their 80s, the various heirs in the succession process. Each time one passes away, a political vacuum will create. Similarly, in the Sultanate of Oman, we have a ruler here who's been in power since 1970. He has no sons or heirs to take over after him. So we have all kinds of opportunities waiting in the wings. I think the best way to understand why there hasn't been this Arab Spring in the Gulf yet properly is that they've been able to use their increased resources compared to the rest of the Arab world to buy off the population for the time being. But as many reports are coming out at the moment, including IMF reports, this is not a sustainable strategy, as it's massively increasing the break-even oil price these countries need in order to keep their budgets in balance.
All right, Christopher, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks very much.
That was Christopher Davidson. He's a reader in Middle East politics at Durham University, author of After the Sheiks, The Coming Collapse of the Gulf Monarchies.
Coming up next, our guest calls for deep pragmatism to bridge the gap between what he calls us and them. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.